Okay, thank you very much. I very much enjoyed the first talk this morning where it pointed out two computer scientists were asking quantum physicists what was the experimental confirmation that quantum computing would be interesting, would be exponentially powerful. And as exciting as it is that they asked that, it's also kind of embarrassing that in our field, there's not a lot of experimentalists trying to answer that question too. And that's what our talk, my talk here is gonna kind of address, because if we're gonna spend a lot of effort and, you know, billions of dollars of the government's money across the world, you would think that we want to understand as quickly as possible whether the assumptions of quantum mechanics are gonna be true for these very big qubit systems that we want to build to do these kind of computations. Now, we expect it to be true, and if it's not true, we expect it to be some experimental error that we have to fix. But nevertheless, we would like to know as soon as possible whether that's making any sense. So what I'm going to talk about is some experiments we've been planning for a year or 2 years or so, where we're gonna try to do that you know, as soon as possible, and you'll get to maybe see how soon that is. So I'm gonna start with John Preskill's definition of quantum supremacy for a well-defined problem, show more computation power for a quantum computer, at least paraphrase that. So that's what we're gonna try to do, show the power. Now, I wanted to mention that quantum supremacy, this word supremacy is kind of not a good word right now. Okay, and you know, maybe advantage would be better or something. Okay, I actually find this to be fine. I always use quantum in front of supremacy so that people know what we're talking about. But I want to make a point that in fact what we're trying to do is show this, but go beyond that. Okay, I think significantly beyond that. So I can't think of a word that goes beyond supremacy. Is it quantum supremacy or hyper supremacy? So maybe that word it's maybe a little bit too modest for what we're trying to do, in fact. Because what we're trying to do also, and we want to show this in a very, very solid way, is to show that we're having an exponentially growing computational space and demonstrate that directly as we can, which of course is why we're interested in the quantum computing. And then to show this, you need to have very good fidelity of your qubits, both low intrinsic errors and to know how to calibrate and control them in a controllable way. And in fact, we're going to use this to validate control. And then and do this in a universal way, so it's forward compatible to actually build some kind of universal quantum computer, combining, let's say, these two, doing error correction, etc. Okay, so we want to do all this at the same time, and that's what I want to kind of talk about today, is our goals, our plans to kind of do that. So the way I like to look at it is we're going to build this little physics experiment, okay, with a dilution refrigerator and some electronics in this scale. We're going to take some data so that we want to know if that thing is working right, then we're going to have to use some kind of classical supercomputer to check this, which has huge amounts of memory to be able to check the quantum calculations for that. Okay, so you know, can this little physics group do something that a big supercomputer with all that engineering effort can use to check? So let's go through the algorithm of how this thing works, okay? And what we're going to do is take a bunch of qubits, and then you're going to do a bunch of single qubit gates and two qubit gates in the natural way, one after the other, where the single qubit gates, you choose some gates, you choose it randomly from a gate set, but you know what it is. So it's known but random choice, and it'll be with Cliffords, and it has to be a non-Clifford two. And then you're going to have some entangling gates, which will be, could be a C0. It's equivalent, you can have a CZ. Okay? Single qubit gates, two qubit gates. We do this for n qubits, a certain amount of time, a certain depth. and then you measure the outcome K at the end. So you just run this quantum algorithm. Again, it's known, but randomly chosen, okay? And you run that and you measure, let's say, K times. And of course, there are 2^n possible outcomes of this here, given the kind of the random nature, you're basically making all possible outcomes possible. And we'll repeat the sampling, say 100,000 times or so, but if n is big enough, it's just gonna be a small subset of all the possible states. Now, if there's no structure in this problem, okay, the randomly chosen Clifford, not Clifford gate, there's no structure in the problem. You can't guess what it's going to be. So the only guess you could have is that any k has a probability of classical 1/2^n. So 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, all the states are more or less equally probable, okay? But that's not what the physics is going to give you, in fact, because it's a coherent quantum system. And the way to illustrate what you're going to see is very simple. I'm just taking a powerful laser pointer with ground glass. And when I put that laser pointer through the ground glass, we're gonna get a speckle pattern, okay, here. And you know, if maybe in the back of the room, it's hard to see the speckle, it looks kind of like a uniform distribution. But if you're up in the front, you'll see that in some directions it's bright, and some directions it's dim. And that's because you either have constructive or destructive interference between the light going through the ground glass, okay? And the analogy here is that the different directions are the different possible qubit states, and the probability is the intensity, okay? So some of these outcomes, it's gonna be more likely than others in this kind of speckle pattern. Now I want you to mention here, see here, that when you look at the speckle pattern, first of all, the speckle pattern that you see here is telling that we have a coherent source and coherence going through the ground glass. So the speckle tells you something about coherence, but also what we want to do is we want to be able to predict which are the directions where it's bright or dim. And of course, you could do that if you know exactly what this ground glass looks like. In the case of the qubit, if you know what the randomly chosen but known algorithm is. So to predict what the speckle pattern is, you're going to just calculate the wave function, just doing a supercomputer calculation if n is big enough. You just integrate the Schrödinger equation to get an n psi, and then you just find out what the probability is for doing the gate, you store that in a lookup table. And for 45 qubits or so, you're really taxing superconductors, and you have to have a huge amount of storage to be able to do that. It's very big. In fact, that's the limiting factor in doing the calculation. So you measure some states, you then which take maybe a few seconds. You compute this, which maybe takes days and a huge storage and in a lookup table, and then compare. What you're going to do is you're going to figure, look, I'm going to measure the states that are the brightest, that have the lightest, the largest probability. And then you check whether you're measuring the largest probability states by doing a correlation with the cross entropy, where here K is the sampling you're making, and then P, you plug that K into the P's of the K of the lookup table. And since you expect you're going to see the brightest, most probable states, these P's are bigger than P classical, so the entropy will be larger if you're seeing the brightest states, if everything is working right. And in fact, if you compare to theory, if it's full classic quantum, this S is 0.42, and if it's classical, it's this minus 1. So you could tell the difference between that. So then you try that with a few seconds worth of data. You then want to try a second example to check that. So you choose these random gates, take a second of data, calculate in a few hours or a day, and check that again. And you keep doing that until you run out of money. Okay, and then that's all you can do if it's big enough. Okay. Let's go in more detail. Where does the speckle come from? For each state, you have a real and imaginary part of psi. You basically, in the real and imaginary part, you have a Gaussian distribution of the real and imaginary parts. So here's two Gaussians. The radius here is the square root of probability. And with these two Gaussians, you get an exponential distribution here. So this is for about 20 qubits, a numerical simulation of what we're doing here. This is the raw index from 000 to all ones here. This is the probability distribution normalized to the classical distribution here. And you see this is kind of exponential-like with a lot of small ones and a few big ones. So this is the Porter-Thomas distribution, exponential distribution. I want to make a point here that's really important. Note that as you go this way, this is just going up and down and suitably in some really complex way. Okay, this kind of shows that you have very high computational complexity in this, because when you go from one index to the next, it's, you know, there's no information there to know what the next value is going to be. It's highly computational complex system. Okay, now you can see this Porter-Thomas distribution by just taking this data and just putting it through a sorting algorithm, just sort it from low probability to high. And then you can see, if you tilt your head, this is an exponentially decaying distribution, as you would expect from here. Now, yes?
It's not immediately clear, at least to me, that uniform distribution is the only classical one out there. For example, in your back to your laser speckle example, right, I can think about in which scenarios I will have these spiky peaks. For example, I take some salt and pepper and just sprinkle it around. Right? Now, on top of some uniform background, I will have some very speckled, very spiky peaks. So how would I distinguish from these scenarios? Or, for example, a levee walk, say, the way that the sharks come.
So let's move on. I don't want to spend too much time on this. Basically, there's a lot of theoretical proofs that say why it's this Porter-Thomas exponential distribution, and this kind of idea of the normal thing is the standard explanation for what's going on. We can talk later. This is a detail that, you know, we do get a Porter-Thomas exponential distribution for these kind of problems as long as you have some things. Let's talk about it later because I'm going to run out of time. Okay, now, if there's one error anywhere in the system, okay, then you're going to lose the ability to predict this. So this is the data where you just have one error, a bit flip or phase flip, anywhere in the system, and then you look at the distribution and it goes flat and classical. Okay, and what's nice about that is that you can now actually predict what's going to go on with your cross entropy if you have errors, okay? So what's going to happen is you're going to get a S quantum if there's no error, and then you're going to get an S classical if there's one or more errors. And you just have to compute the probability of no error, which is basically the probability of no error is exponential minus N the total number of errors in the system. So that's something we can know given how the qubits work. That's something we can estimate. Okay, so you know what an exponential decay. This is S total minus S classical, normalized cross entropy going from 0 to 1. As long as the number of errors is less than a few, then you'll be able to see that it's different than 0, and you'll know that you saw some speckle pattern. Okay. So, of course, the problem is real physical qubits have errors, and you get effectively the blue screen of death for your experiment when you have your error, okay? And then, what is this number? I'm just going to take two qubit errors because they're the biggest problem that we have. They're the hardest thing to make work well. And if you take 49 qubits, because 2 to the 49 is at this quantum supremacy regime, you make a 7x7 array, so you have to have a depth of at least about 7 so that you fully entangle across the array and you get the Porter-Thomas distribution. and I take a measured value, what we get for two qubit errors of 0.5%, then the number of errors is about one or two. Okay, so it's hard. Okay, and we probably have to do a little bit better here in a real experiment, but it's kind of something we can think about doing. Okay, so what we're going to do is, that's the idea. We've done a mock-up, a first experiment to show how this works on 9 qubits. Okay, and here's our 9 qubits right here. They're read out in this circuitry, controlled here. And then these qubits can be coupled to each other via these two inductive loops here that gives us mutual inductance coupling. So the qubit Hamiltonian control is a full qubit control, H dot sigma on each of the qubits. And then this coupling here gives us a swap interaction where we can change a photon from one qubit. So that's an XX plus YY interaction. In the way that we build this, this H here can go up to about 200 megahertz. This G can go up to 300 megahertz. And these values here can be calibrated and known and controlled to about 1 nanosecond time scale with a coherence time of about, let's say 10, 20 microseconds or so. Okay, and we can calibrate this, this is amazing, to about 0.1 megahertz on a, let's say 100 megahertz. So it's a part in a thousand we can calibrate it. I do want to mention here that when we run the algorithm, when we do the calibrations, we calibrate one pair at a time. We calibrate the n pair, next pair, next pair, next pair, and we calibrate that. However, when we run the algorithm, we're going to be turning all of them on and off at the same time. So we're going to operate in a way that we didn't calibrate. And is it going to work? How would we know that it's working or not? And we're going to know by doing the quantum supremacy experiment. So this is a little bit different algorithm than what you saw before, but it's kind of similar idea. We're going to take, here's 5 qubits. We put in a pi pulse to put in a 1 state in 2 of the qubits. Then we're going to set the qubit frequencies to a random value of 50, 100 megahertz or so, but known, okay? But then during this setting, we're going to turn on the couplers for the swap interaction, and we're going to turn them all on and all off in this kind of on and off pattern, where kind of on average, you're getting a swapping interaction, but sometimes we go shorter and sometimes get longer. So these are a bunch of unitary operations that are in fact photon conserving. So in the end, we're expecting to see 2 photons here, but of course, with all the swapping interactions, they're going to go around in a way that's, in principle, hard to, well, we have to calculate to know that. So this is the data on 5 qubits. These are all the possibilities where the qubits can be. We have 4 instances here that are, again, randomly chosen but known. And we see a nice distribution here where there's lots of small probabilities and a few big probabilities. And the what states for high and low change, but you still see the same thing, lots of low and few high. And I'm going to say, just by looking at the raw histograms of the probabilities, you can kind of see that there's a speckle pattern. It's not uniform. It's kind of this exponential distribution. And to check that, what you can do is just take all this data, and all that, we have 1,000 instances, and histogram all the probabilities, okay? And when you histogram the probabilities, you see that for 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you get the histogram, and of course, as you go to more probabilities, the probability for each state goes down, and we're increasing the number of states that we're computing on this for 9 up to something like 126 states. It's a big computation. Then what you do is you normalize this with the number of states, and everything collapses onto one line as e to the minus x, so it collapses to an exponential distribution as you would expect, right? This is the Porter-Thomas exponential distribution. Now, you see it's getting a little bit different there, and that could be understood very simply by doing an experiment where for the 7 qubits, you just wait 100 cycles or so before you take the histogram, and you see then you lose the exponential distribution, And now it's getting very close to a uniform distribution, as you expect, as you lose all your coherence. It then turns into more of a classical distribution. So the decoherence kills this qubit speckle. Okay, so you can be a little bit more quantitative here, and this is some kind of measure, a distance from an exponential distribution. The number of entangling cycles when it's zero, it's not very exponential at all, okay? With one, it's pretty good, but at two, it's very close to an exponential distribution. And then it gets worse over time as, you know, you have decoherence. And this is expected. The more qubits you have, the worse it gets. What's kind of amazing here is you get this 9-qubit full interaction, full entanglement in only 2 cycles. And that's because you're turning it on and off all at the same time and doing some very complex interaction. Okay? You can compare that distribution with your model predictions in red. Again, we know what the gates are. And you see where it's low, it's predicted to be low, and where it's high, it's predicted to be high, all across the board here. So the speckle pattern matches what happens. Where it's bright, you see it's bright. And you can do the cross entropy to check that, which you can also think as fidelity. Okay, so 0 here is a random guess, and 1 is a perfect prediction. And for 5 qubits, you see the fidelity is pretty high, 95% or so, going down to about 80% after 10 of these cycles. Okay, and again, it's going linearly down, as you would expect, as you have the decay of it. That was for 5, and then let's just look at it from 3 all the way to 9. Okay, and as you increase the number of qubits, or you increase the length of it, the fidelity goes down, as you would expect, because there's more chances for error. And you can kind of work this out, and it's about 0.3% error per gate and per cycle. You just kind of add up the number of gates and cycles, and that tells you, you know, how far down you are here, which is, that's actually pretty low for a fully calibrated system. And again, if we had control errors, that would make all this work. That's just intrinsic errors, control errors, how well it's correlated, turning them all and off, and does it work properly? Okay. Now, that's for 9. You can take this number and say what's going to happen for 45 qubits. For, you know, 1, 2, 3 cycles, it'll be here at the 20, 40, 50% level. So this kind of makes you think, if everything, nothing goes wrong, which it could, okay, but if nothing goes wrong, we might be able to do enough qubits to get into a quantum supremacy. At about 45, 50 qubits, things get very hard to calculate on a superconductor, a supercomputer. Okay, I do want to mention something here. When we talk about quantum complexity, is the quantum complexity equal to the 2 to the number of qubits? Because I hear that all the time coming from experimental groups who are now building a lot of qubits. This is absolutely false. Okay, and it turns out, for example, if you take a linear chain of qubits and you just have qubit states, then the computation, classical computation, classical computer computation of the quantum state is not very complex at all. That's a very easy problem to solve. Okay? So one should be very careful when you're talking about quantum supremacy to think carefully, what do you mean by the computational complexity of the problem? And most physicists don't understand this. The Google group, as theory group, has done a very exhaustive understanding of this. And for example, so if we're not claiming two-state linear chain. This is a linear chain. If it were two-state linear chain, it would be an easy computation problem. But it turns out that if you were to look at the cross entropy versus just qubit, two-level states, the computation is wrong. We get the wrong answer. What we have to do is include the 0 state, the 1 state, and the 2 state. in order to get things right. And that's because when these things are interacting, the second excited state is giving some virtual occupation and some phase shifts that actually change the computation. And when you do that, and again, as long as you have the number of steps and your run-cuta integration, as long as the steps are short enough, then you can get very good cross-entropy. So you need to think very carefully about what's going on and how you're going to do your computational complexity simulation. Okay. I'm going to skip this and just go on to one last thing before last few minutes. Once we have this figured out and calibrated and whatever, it's nice to try to do some physics experiments, especially since things are working well. I would like to talk about an experiment we did to look for the Hofstadter butterfly. It's an idea that was thought about by Hofstadter in the 60s. You can basically think of it as a two-dimensional sheet of atoms, say graphene, and you want to know the energy eigenstates of this system versus magnetic field, okay? And for 150 sites, this is something not too hard to compute. You can compute all the energy eigenstates versus the normalized magnetic field, where this B is normal at one, that's one flux quantum into a site, which turns out to be about 10,000 Tesla for normal material. So that's not something you can directly do experimentally. Your normal range is about there. But what's nice about this calculation, here's the Hamiltonian, you get a swapping between the neighboring sites due to the coupling between this, and then the magnetic fields gives you this cosine dependence on the HZ of each one. You get this very nice versus B field, this very nice kind of fractal behavior where there's bands where there's no energy levels and all this structure in it. It's very a beautiful picture. If you do that for 9 qubits and map it to our system, this is what you expect. And again, you get these kind of bands here, as you saw in the other Hofstadter butterfly picture. And you also see very complex behavior, okay? So what we're going to do is run our experiment. It's calibrated. It's checked with the quantum supremacy. It's tuned in. We know it's working. How close can we get our experiment to match this beautiful thing? If we understand they have good control, we know how everything's calibrated, how good can we get? And this is the experimental data, right? We calibrate the system, and then we run the experiment. We're not adjusting things to get it to work right. That would be cheating. We're not cheating. And you see that the experimental data points lie really well on top of the theoretical lines. And in fact, the colors here is how far they're off. Most of the time, it's a few megahertz, maybe mostly under 5, on a 300 megahertz scale. So we're about 1%, maybe 2% errors in doing this. And we see all the complicated features here that you would expect in this spectrum. Okay? So we have a quantum computer that we can control very well and get things to work properly. And, you know, that's partly because we ran the quantum supremacy experiment and really tested how everything was doing. So we can extract complex, physically useful information, from these kind of simulations if it's all controlled right. So I'm hoping to indicate how useful that is. So I have to skip to the end, just say that at this point, we're working in the Google Labs to scale up this even more. So this is a 22 qubit chip. This is two rows of 11 qubits connected in kind of a ladder arrangement. We make our qubit chip here. We bump on that with indium balls. We connect it to our wiring chip. And then those are wire bonded that go out to all our microwave controls on the outside. And then that's put in our refrigerator, lines going up, and then control electronics. So this crate here can control about 22 qubits. And you can see if we want to do more qubits, we just add more wiring and add more crates, and we hope to do something big soon. So in terms of the plans, we have 9-qubit devices, both gate and continuous space. The errors are quite low. The worst errors are 2-qubit, which are about in the 0.5% range. Okay, that's really pretty good for a big system, and we've shown algorithms to do that. We have a 22-qubit device in test, a supremacy device, 45 to 50 qubits, a square array we're hoping to make by the end of the year. Also working on other flux qubits and newer devices too. Okay, thank you very much.
Hi, John. So I had a quick question. So I was a little unclear about the first part of your talk where you were talking about the speckle pattern or...
The first part?
Yeah, where you were talking about this, what did you call it, a speckle?
Yeah, the speckle, yes.
The speckle. So I didn't quite understand. So were you saying that there isn't a classical process that can produce a speckle pattern?
When you have classical light, if I have classical light going through ground glass, since the light is not coherent, you're not going to get interference. And you're just going to get a uniform distribution.
No, I understand that.
And then the quantum nature. And I'm going to say that the same kind of similar. It's really the same idea happens with the quantum, where you're having interference of all the states, and then you get the speckle pattern out of it.
So I understand that. But you know, in terms of the question you started with about supremacy, where you're really comparing to classical computational complexity, you know. So you have to sort of say, well, there isn't some other classical process of low complexity that can produce a pattern like that.
The way I think about it is there's no kind of classical shortcut to predict the speckle other than to write out the big full Hilbert space and then crank through the calculation. And then I think the Google Theory Group has motivated, I think it's in the paper, that this is not something you can do. But, you know, clearly it would be, you know, interesting for people to think about it more. But I'm gonna make a bold assertion and say, if you could figure that out, then you know how to solve quantum problems way better. Because since this is a random problem with no structure, if you're solving it efficient classically, that's fantastic. Then we should be able to solve a general problem that way. So to me, given the random nature of it, it's kind of claiming that there's no more efficient way to, you know, solve the problem. Okay, so that's kind of the thinking there. Again, if someone comes up with some more efficient way, that's great.
So I think in both the experimental things you showed us, you conserved the number of excitations.
Yeah.
You had one in the second part,
yes,
and some number in the first part. So is that is it a problem doing Hamiltonians which don't, or?
What happens is, yes, so what we're doing is we're only looking at the data that has, let's say, you know, n over 2 photons that come out. So if it's a 9-qubit, you're going to put in 4 excitations. And you're going to get 4 excitations about 50% of the time. So you're throwing away some of the data, the decay events. But it's not very many of those events, and it does improve the coherence of the system, maybe a factor or two. This is why we saw 0.3% error per device. If you look at the devices where you could get infidelity from energy decay, that's more like 0.5, 0.6%. So those numbers kind of make sense. Clearly, if you go back to the original algorithm I showed at the beginning, where you aren't conserving photon numbers, then you have to worry about it too. It's a factor two for a process.
But you can, in principle, you can do those algorithms.
Yeah, yeah.
You just didn't want
to. Yeah, you can do it in different ways.
You talked about both random circuits of 2-qubit gates and simulating XY models.
Right.
So when you get to 49 qubits, are you going to be doing both types of tests, or is there a reason to prefer one type or the other?
So what'll happen is when we get to 49 qubits, we will test the qubits with the random circuit. And what's very interesting is we can test for the fidelity of the 49-qubit device versus summing up what we know all the single and two-qubit errors are. And we're going to do a very careful test of that, see if it makes sense. But at that point, we have a circuit where you could run anything you want, so we can run arbitrary algorithms. The natural thing for us to do with the square wave is to run a surface code, but it'll be able to run something. So one of the things that we will be doing, which is what D-Wave and IBM has done, is to make a cloud service. So our plan is to do that also. So if people here want to use that kind of device and run some algorithms, everyone should be able to do that. And, you know, with the supremacy, you're really calibrating and checking things very accurately. So we're hoping we'll get some really, you know, nice results out of that.
So I really like the part about the Hofstadter butterfly, and I was wondering, I guess you could put it as, what was the quantum algorithm you were using to get that data? Were you doing like phase estimation, or like just kind of how did it work?
Yes, I had to skip over that. That's actually not, it's kind of a new idea here. So what you do is, you know, you're basically, you want to know the eigenmodes of a bell. You strike the bell and you listen to the tones, okay? So what we do is we strike the bell and listen to the tone on one of the qubits with basically a Ramsey fringe. You do a pi over two, that's going to be oscillating around. You watch the oscillation with another pi over two and also 90 degree phase shift, so you're doing both X and Y. So this is a Ramsey fringe with a bunch of different times measuring X and Y, and then you take the Fourier transform and then you listen to all the tones, okay? And you expect 9 tones. So, you know, you might want to pick out 9 from that. But then what you do is you do the same thing on all the other qubits and you get the tones of all the qubits. And then the real tones are going to be the ones where you see the tones on all the different qubits, because it's all or most of them. So what we do is we take this Fourier transform and then we just average over it and we get the pulses here, and then you just pick out the 9 biggest tones. And that's the ones that I showed there. Just for your own interest, maybe, is you can do the same thing for a 2-qubit excitation, which is much less clear on how to do that, so it's in the paper. And if you look, do the same kind of Ramsey fringe and look at these correlators, you then get this for the four outputs, and you Fourier transform that, and that gives you the tones. So these are all the pairs, all the possible pairs for 2-qubit excitations, and these are the averages. And then you can pick out the 45 energy levels, or at least most of them. You know, there's noise here. So this is not so obvious how to do that. It's in the paper. It's kind of a neat theory development on how to do that. Thank you. I got to show that. I wanted to show that.
I have another question about that same butterfly diagram.
Yeah.
It seems like the larger errors are showing up in particular parts of the diagram. Can you say a little bit about if I should be worried about this, or if you can characterize
it? Yeah, I can comment. You see that the yellow is kind of showing up here, which are higher frequencies, so it's oscillating faster and probably harder to get it right. And you see there's a bunch of crossings here, so, you know, they're probably going to mix and do that. So, you know, yeah. And yeah, see right here, there's a lot more error, and that's probably due to the fast oscillation. I mean, that's 300 megahertz, and we're probably taking data every nanosecond or so, and, you know, that's pretty good. So, we haven't done that extensive analysis on this, but, it, you know, we kind of figure this looks pretty good.
I had a question about how robust the witness that you're using for the speckle contrast. Are there no sort of simple mixed states that could produce the same contrast that you see for a single pure state?
I'm not understanding the question, I'm sorry.
So you're using the interference contrast in this sort of speckle analogy to certify that you're seeing the simulation
yes.
that you expect?
Yes.
And I'm wondering how robust that is. For example, are there no simple mixed states that might reproduce the same results?
Okay. Yes. No. I don't think so. I'm trying to figure out how to prove that. You know what happens is if you change, you just put in one X error or one Z error anywhere in the circuit, then your cross entropy value goes to zero. So you have to get exactly right, or else you will not get the right answer. And you can show that with simulations. So I think it's a pretty, to what our extent, it looks like a really reliable way to do it. And you know, it means if you do the experiment and you don't calibrate it, there's a minus sign somewhere or something, you will not get a good result. So I think it's really, really robust to doing that.
So how are the 49 qubits going? What do you think? Are there some major issues?
The 22 qubit device is working very well. Everything works. It's in test right now. We're doing it. The fidelities look okay, and you know, we're little things we have to do to fix that. And we're writing a lot of code to automate it because you don't want to be tuning this up by hand at all. The 49-qubit device is based on fabrication that we've gotten everything to work on individual steps. So we think that it's highly likely that we'll be able to build it and the basic thing will work. But we have to see. We have to build it. And there's still a few more tests and some iterations we need to do. But all the basic elements of that. So. I kind of said this a little bit carefully. I'm sure we can build something by 49, which is not so easy, and we'll put it in the refrigerator to test by the end of the year. Whether it'll work, you know, is another story, okay? But I'm going to say that the 22-qubit, it's not working perfectly, but it's working well enough that it's not a stupid experiment. It's something we're going to want to do. One of the interesting things, though, is, and this is what gives me a lot of confidence that this is not so crazy, is you expect as you scale up the number of qubits, it's harder to control them. No surprise there, okay? And it's just all these things can go wrong. When we scale up to more and more qubits, we have to make the design and the chips better in order for this to work. And when we do that, we see way less crosstalk and other kind of control problems than we were doing previously. So if, for example, for the Z lines before, you change the qubit frequencies and you put current in on one line and it's going to do that qubit, but then the other qubit here changed by a part in a few thousand, okay? Now it's immeasurable. At a part to 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5. Okay, and the same thing for the microwaves. Before it was kind of a problem. We can get around it in some of these experiments by detuning, whatever, and now it's pretty hard to measure. So things are, you know, because things are getting better, we're optimistic, but, you know, okay, let's get to work. So this looks like, you know, we'll be really testing some stuff at the end of the year, beginning of next year. Seriously.
So, just Just a comment. I mean, people seem to keep circling back to this issue of, well, can you prove that there's no classical algorithm that would reproduce this pattern of speckle? I mean, I think it's worth it for people to understand that, you know, there is no hope in the present state of complexity theory that you would prove any such result unconditionally. Okay. You know, you just can't, right? The, you know, the best that, you know, one can do is to prove it under some reasonable assumption. So Li Ji Chen and I had this paper recently where we tried to do exactly that, right? And, you know, it's not very satisfying what we can do, but we can start from an assumption which is not itself about any sampling problem, which is just about, like, is it hard to predict the, you know, whether an amplitude is large or small, basically, to guess that. And if that's true, then we can show that this reproducing the speckle pattern is also classically hard. So, you know, so maybe that, you know, helps to improve your confidence. But I mean, I think, you know, what you said earlier is, you know, ultimately it comes down to challenging someone. Well, you know, if you think that's false, then, you know,
find the algorithm.
Yeah, you're right. You write a program and go predict the speckle pattern. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, that's good. In some sense that's what the applied cryptography community, you know, ends up doing in practice, just putting out challenges, and, you know, we'll sort of have to do the same.
Am I correct to say that if you could figure out that algorithm, that would be useful for the whole field of quantum?
Well, I think that's plausible.
Okay.
I mean, you know, there's no proof because
I understand.
Yeah.
But that's the difficulty of the problem. You would totally change the way we do quantum calculations.
It's hard for me to imagine how you have a sampling algorithm for random quantum circuits that's not just, you know, going to work for anything, right? But, you know, I can't prove that there's not such that there's not one. If it works for any circuit, of course that's BQP complete. If it works for random circuits, we don't know. Predicting the speckle pattern just means simulating the output distribution. So it's, you know, it's BQP complete by definition. But yeah, okay, for random circuits, you know, conceivably it's easier, but it, it's hard to understand how.
But that's a nice challenge for people. Thank you.
Okay, let's conclude the morning session, and now it's time for lunch, so let's thank John again and all the speakers.